session number 4588, reel 3.
Mrs. Burkell, tape 3.
Could
you give me any other examples of refugee children you helped? I believe there was one little boy that you actually adopted later on.
Well, you couldn't legally adopt anybody until 1944. But we took on, I mean, it was like an adoption. I mean, we took complete responsibility, like we did of Big Harry, which was Harry Gretzer, who was just a dossier on my desk in my office. I had a rule with my secretariat that they must never touch education. Education, I dealt with education. I didn't mind them buying clothes or anything of that sort. I didn't want to be bothered with that, but education. Because, you see, having been up to the university really tells you very little of how the university ticks. And my secretary was also a Unamite, but a Quaker, but had gone down and had no personal experience with the university. And whenever she tried to do something clever, I had to apologize, which I found very irritating. So I made this rule, and my second secretary found this headmaster's letter and put the dossier on my desk. And it was about a boy who was going to take O levels and who was very bright and whose brother had been mucked about by the movement and made to leave school at after O levels and put in most unsuitable work, though he was obviously extremely academic. And the headmaster did not want it to happen to the second boy. He had written to the head office, who gave him a dusty answer. So he thought he'd try the regional office. And I looked at it, and so I tried to sell him amongst all my friends. But of course in Cambridge people are not really interested in youngsters who are going to do good O levels. They are interested in more advanced students. And I got terribly worried about this boy. More and more worried. And got really quite ill because I felt something must be done for this boy. And so at last my husband said, you better have him, as Big Harry was finishing at Trinity. And that is how we got what we call Little Harry. Because Big Harry, of course, had three names, Gert, Edzard, Harry, Reuter. And I told his father, from today he will be Harry Reuter. I can't have him go to a public school with those two other names. His life won't be worthwhile living. But I didn't foresee that in a few years' time I would have a Harry who had nothing else but Harry as a name. So it became Big and Little. Big being well onto 6 foot and Little being a normal size. And this all involved itself with my asking the two Harrys sitting in the drawing room with me to put some coal on the fire. And I said, Harry, put some coal on the fire. And they both got up and bowed to one another and did nothing. And I got very cross. And so it became Big and Little, and it is still today Big and Little. Little Harry came from Vienna. He was a ward in Chancery because his father had died, his mother had died, all his relatives had got out of Austria to America, but left the two orphaned children behind as wards in Chancery. And they were in a very unhappy state. And when Adolf Hitler came in, the law court took no further interest and gave all their belongings to the Nazis. And the older brother wrote to, looked at the Times every day and looked who was giving money to the Baldwin Fund for refugees and wrote to Hopeful, the people who he thought might help. And Bloomsbury House, the London head office, got very fed up with this because they got people coming in about these boys. But at last one really emphatic lady who was a novelist and poetess was having no nonsense and made Bloomsbury House do something and got her two nephews to guarantee the two boys. And that is the way these two boys came to England and went to Bedford Modern School as boarders. This was quite successful. But both the nephews were very badly bombed during the war and could not carry on the guarantee. So it had to become a broken guarantee, which meant that the head office took responsibility. And their system at that time was that any child in grammar school had to leave it after O levels and go to work, which of course was one of the things I had the bitterest fight over during that period. And the headmaster, having seen the misfortune of the older boys, did not want to happen. And so this is how little Harry came into the family and settled into it extremely well. And
but did you actually adopt him when you could in 1944?
Well, it wasn't worthwhile.
No. I thought he had your surname.
Yes, he had. Now this of course is interesting. What we did do, I mean, we had offered him to take on our name with the permission of my husband's father, because all the Burkills in Great Britain or anywhere in the world all come from the same root. Then they're all related. And then we did take out the legal, what is that word called? To change your name legally.
Deed poll.
Yes, we did have a deed poll for little Harry because we knew there was still some money in Austria which we wanted to get out for him, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without a deed poll. In England, anybody can change their name. There's no law against that. But if you have a legal position, it makes it difficult. And that is really why we did it. We didn't get much out because Austria only paid 10% of what there was, whilst of course Germany did pay out 100%. But anyhow, it was a little help. Harry only wanted to change his name when he became a university lecturer in Sheffield and found that nobody could pronounce his name.
What was his name?
Retzer. And he felt so fed up with it that he came home and said, I think, can I change my name? And we, of course, happily agreed to this.
Would you mind explaining, though, Mrs. Burkell, what the situation was regarding adoption? You mentioned earlier that this couldn't happen until the year 1944.
Now, in England, the law until 1944 was that you could only adopt English-born children. You could not adopt a foreign child. When the Home Office realized that a great many of the so-called children who were in Great Britain would have lost their parents in the concentration camps, they felt the people who had taken care of them should be able to give the children the security of adoption. And they brought in this law that the adoption was not like the adoption of, like the naturalization of a grown-up. You see, when they were adopted, they of course became British subjects. But it wasn't like the naturalization of a grown-up where you have to give guarantors and it's all rather a big business and it costs a lot of money and it goes through the police. This adoption was done through, the children were seen by two officers of the Home Office, of the Children's Department. In their actual surroundings. We attended the interviews as the legal guardians of the children, as the movement was the legal guardian of all the children. And usually the adoption was granted. One had a certain amount of difficulties with the religious committees in Bloomsbury House, who had took the attitude that no Jewish child could be adopted by a Christian. That the religion of a child went through the mother. The only time in Jewish religion when the mother matters at all is when the person dies, because he's the son of Rebecca, etc., not the son of Josiah. We had, of course, this problem, which was a very difficult problem. Whilst the movement was active, that was till 1948, it was for the chairman of the movement to decide whether he would allow an adoption. But when the movement closed its offices, though of course the regents went on working, and anyhow I did go on working, the children's dossiers had to be returned to the religious committees of we had the older dossiers of our children, but they had to be sent to the religious committees of the particular child. Well, as about 90% of all the children who came in by the movement were Jewish, the large amount of dossiers went to the Jewish committee. Amongst them was a child who had been an orphan, was an illegitimate child of a Jewish housemaid and a Protestant commercial traveler, who had given up every right on the child. We had all the papers in the dossier. And who was brought over at the age of 2, weighing 22 pounds. The child was adopted by quite a small farmer who had no children in East Anglia. They were an absolute marvelous couple. They took fantastic care of the child. They moved their small holdings away from where they had lived so that nobody should know he was not their child. The child was absolutely happy. He got a grammar school place. They got him up to weight. He had been very ill, and they saw him through a severe illness, and they wanted to adopt him because they wanted to leave what they had to the child. But his mother had been Jewish, and the head of the Jewish Refugee Committee would not allow us to let these people who had saved this child and had given it such love and care allow it to be adopted. And we had to say, well, let the child wait till it's 21 and then it can take British nationality.
But was this typical of the Jewish refugee organization?
Oh, we had children kidnapped, we had all sorts of things done. I mean, we won't put it in.
You see, you had children kidnapped.
The Orthodox Jews were extremely difficult to cope with. In fact, the difficult people were the Catholic Committee, whose attitude was, we have saved those children's life. They should become priests and nuns. There's no need for any of them to meet one another, though they are brothers and sisters. And I used to fight the Catholic Committee in Bloomsbury House. But whilst the movement was active, I always won, because the movement was above any religious committee. So we were all right in that. But I had a family of 3 children, 2 boys and 1 baby girl. The father was a doctor, a Christian, married to a Jewish wife. And his wife became pregnant. And of course it was all wrong for an Aryan to have intercourse with a Jew. And they made this man's life so appalling that he committed suicide. The children, we wanted to bring the mother and the children to England. The mother would not leave because she had a mother and she didn't want to leave her mother. But the 3 boys came, the 2 boys and girl came over, and of course they were Catholic. The little girl was a complete baby. And the 2 boys were together in a boarding school in Hitchin, a Catholic boarding school in Hitchin. But the little girl was in a convent somewhere in Sussex. And I felt that they only had one another. And it was terribly important that they should be should meet. And I had terrible trouble about this, but I at last won that they should have their school holidays, all three together in a Catholic family. The elder boy was very bright. We had a system in the movement, and getting back to other things, that when we had the evacuation, about which I must tell you, that we had, from having about having brought in on our own in Cambridge in 1938 and early 9, about 70 guaranteed children to Cambridge, which was Sybil Hutton and myself doing the work, who were all guaranteed. With the evacuation, we suddenly had 800 children in the region, for which we, being the center of Region 4, Cambridge, were responsible with all the other committees and so on. And we counted that we would see every child under our care once in 6 months. We were always allowed petrol. There was never any difficulty for us to get petrol. And so we went around the country visiting. And Elizabeth, my secretary, and I had a little game that she would talk to the child and I would talk to the hostess, or vice versa. Then we would get back in the car and decide what we felt. If we had the least doubt that things weren't as they appear to be, we always told them we were coming. We would turn up a fortnight or so later when they didn't expect us. And then, if we were unhappy, which was usual because our instincts were pretty good, we got permission from head office to move the child. That is, to break the guarantee. And we had a hostel in Cambridge, which was very much under our fierce eyes. And we could put a child there until we found it a suitable home. And that worked extremely well.
Did you find that in the majority of cases the children were happy?
Yes, the majority of cases the children were happy. In fact, it was really very touching, because when you went to the villages and you had these children evacuated, settled in working class agricultural homes, to whom really refugees meant nothing. The children were German to them. Yet they were absolutely touching. They said, well, poor little Hans, he's got no parents in this country. We must do the best for poor little Hans, who might be an absolute little horror. And they'd knit for him, and really, they were absolutely marvelous. I mean, I was full of admiration for the ordinary working class person who really showed such loving care. I mean, they took greater care of the refugee child than the ordinary English evacuated child, because the ordinary English evacuated child had parents. And that was very much to their credit.
Did you find a difference between the working class people and middle class people? You know, could you generalize about the middle class people in any way?
Well, one really couldn't. I mean, you see, guaranteed children were practically all middle class, in middle class homes. Now, you see, I think I ought to tell you the very beginning of the movement. when there was the Kristallnacht in November 38, it went through Great Britain like a sort of electric current. Every little town, every village in England said, we must save the children. It was quite a fantastic thing. People who'd never thought about the Nazis or anything else, but when they heard about this murder and burning and all that, that was the reaction. Of course, we were very early on the scene. I started it and I got Sippel Hutton to join me. I tried all sorts of people, but Sippel did, and Mrs. Hartrick got into it. But we were responsible for quite a lot of children in other places, in the small villages around Cambridge. We were the central committee. Now, Lord Samuel went to the Home Office and asked the Home Office to permit unaccompanied children to come into this country. And he asked for 10,000 unaccompanied children. And you see, there was a tradition in England, because you already had the they helped the Children's Fund after the First World War. Then there was the next stage, and the Home Office agreed that a suitable committee could bring in 10,000 unaccompanied children, which was, of course, you have to remember, in 38 there was terrific unemployment in this country. You had to keep the trade unions happy. And the more guaranteed children we could bring in, the more we were free to bring in unguaranteed children. And within 9 months to the beginning of the war, the organization, which was completely haywire to begin with, because we had to do everything through Bloomsbury House. They were all voluntary workers, and they would work, one lady would work on Monday and Wednesday, and the other one on Tuesday and Thursday. The Home Office gave us Bloomsbury House, but they didn't give us any trained Home Office personnel. So you can imagine how files got mixed, how things went wrong, and everything, and nothing could be done excepting through Bloomsbury House. So every child, people who wrote to us in this, in the provinces, had to then channel the things through Bloomsbury House, through the Home Office, through the religious committee in on the continent, until you could get a child out. And this was, of course, very troublesome and very worrying. And of course, grown-ups went through the same routine. Yes. But of course, when you knew that the child was in terrible danger, mm-hmm. it was very frustrating. But in England, within 9 months before the beginning of war, we had brought out just under 10,000 unaccompanied children. And we would have made our permission of 10,000 if one train load from Czechoslovakia hadn't been stopped in Germany with the day the war was declared. And they were Czech Orthodox orphanage, and of course they disappeared. But it was a fantastic work, and I'm terribly keen for the British public to realize that that work was done, which discounts all the families who brought in their own children. These are, and the trust that these continental Jewish people put in us, whom they didn't know, was, of course, quite amazing. That they trusted us. We made two promises, that we would bring up the child in the faith of its fathers, and that we would reunite families as soon as possible. And we kept that very faithfully and well, whatever Jewish committees may say. I know we did in Region 4.
There must have been a tremendous pressure on your financial resources at this time, when you had this great influx after Kristallnacht.
Well, you see, we of course were lucky in Cambridge. I went round the town with my handbag full of pretty photographs of pretty children. Whenever I met a friend, I said, wouldn't you like a nice refugee child? And we got our 70-odd children all guaranteed. So they didn't cost, they did cost us. Now, we promised the families in Cambridge who took on children that we would look after their medical care, because there was no health service. We would look after their dental care, because Dr. Silberstein would be the doctor to all our children. Marley Ma would be the dentist to all our children. We would pay the grammar school education. So all their responsibility was to have them in their home and feed them and close them.
So when you talk about a guarantee, that is what you mean, is it? To take them in the
a
home?
A guarantee means that a person take, now this was of course again put down by the Home Office. A guarantee meant, until the beginning of war, that you would take a child into your home, keep it educated, and not let it come onto the labor market till 18. That was to keep the trade unions happy. This, of course, was all right for us in Cambridge, because our contact was all academic, and one didn't put one's children on the labor market